This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be better and more helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Ed and Rebecca, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Maurice will read the preamble.
Thanks, Adam. Hi, I'm Maurice. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Austin will read the steps.
Hi, my name is Austin. I'm an alcoholic. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
And Amy will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first speaker is Chris.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Basically, let me start with my sobriety date's October 1st, 2005. My sponsor is Jeff R. Atlantic Group's my home group, and I'm working on steps 6 and 7. I was told fairly on Sunday that I was speaking. It was kind of coincidental. Jeff, my sponsor, was like, I think you should sign up for some outgoing speaker commitments. And that night, Mark asked me to speak, so I'd like to thank my higher power and Mark. So let me start with, I grew up on the Upper East Side, not far from here. I was born in a family, I had everything I needed, went to, private schools, and I do remember, though, after second grade, I was very popular at that point, and my, not to be too humble there, but I remembered after second grade, my mom told me at the end of the summer that I wasn't going back to that school, and I was going to another school, and it was for my own good. But I didn't really get that. So I did feel, when I went to that new school, it was like starting over, and I didn't feel like I fit in. Basically, that I hear that a lot in the meetings about not fitting in, and I definitely identify with that. I didn't start drinking until one summer when I was 13, out in Long Island, at one of my mother's German, and one of her German friends had always served beer and wine, and which is a custom for them. And I remember always wanting to, I was very much into reading, and I remember, reading books about people getting drunk, and I always wanted to see what that was, what they were describing. I just never had the opportunity to until this one night at my parents' friend's house. People left the party, they were serving wine at the party, and I remember that people left the party to go inside from the patio, and the idea just came out of nowhere. I should drink, the leftovers. No one was there to see me, and I think the primary motivation was there was a girl there who I was attracted to, but I didn't have the confidence to ask out. So I was using alcohol at that point to give me the courage to ask her. And needless to say, it backfired. I ended up chasing her. After she turned me down, I ended up kind of chasing her around this woman's house with a knife. And, but I do remember being, getting a lot of attention, and I kind of liked that. And so that was, and then I got very sick and, swore never to do that. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. I didn't, I didn't return to alcohol till a few years later. It was always in the summer. I hung out with a crowd that my best friend was involved with, the dry goods and with beer. I didn't really have summer jobs. My parents weren't around a lot of the time. It didn't become a problem at that point. Just wasted a lot of time. Going through high school and college, I was not a drinker. I was more of a bookish kind of person. When I graduated college, I came back to New York and started working. And immediately after working every night, I would go to the bars and kind of unwind. And I think that's where it started. That progressed. I would drink a lot on my own, and that progressed to the progression definitely took a hold of me, where within a few years I was getting thrown out of bars, hitting on the wrong women, inappropriate comments, and it just got, progressively worse. I thought that if I found the right woman, that would relieve my obsession, and unfortunately, it didn't happen. I met my girlfriend, Christine, and we kept on, drinking. And I did meet her in a bar. But what happened was that I moved to Brooklyn. I thought that might cure my alcoholism. They have bars out there. Just basically, I couldn't go home after work and go home. I had to, my obsession was just get one beer. I remember I was on the subway and that instant of thought of like, maybe I shouldn't get out. And then I would always, the obsession of my mind would always tell me, it's okay, you deserve it. And by, Christine would call me at 8 p.m. Are you coming home for dinner? 9 p.m., midnight, that was... No more calls. And then it was like the guy Rick, who spoke here a few weeks ago, said about how he really intended on going home after a beer or two, but just didn't get home till 4 in the morning, and then went to work at 7, and that was my life. And my sponsor, when I've been working with him, has pointed out, I didn't realize right away that I was an alcoholic. I knew I couldn't stop. And going through the big book with him, he pointed out that the passage where we were entirely unable to stop drinking completely, we were probably alcoholic. And I tried to go. I could go maybe a week at the most, and I knew at the end it wasn't possible. I did have a spiritual experience though, and the night before I came into the rooms, I just felt I was totally hopeless and utter despair. I was all alone. My girlfriend had stopped drinking with me. I wasn't able to leave the apartment safely without getting into trouble. And I did ask a higher power for help. And he did give me some hope. And that was enough to get me here. What it's like now, Atlantic Group has been so great for me. It's almost tailor-made for me. It's just so very structured, and the service commitments, the people, it's what I need to be a part of the program 100% and not have any reservations. Just by doing things really has gotten me serious about getting better. And there have been moments where I have felt relief and a vision of a new life, without worry and fear. I didn't realize that, I thought the way to get ahead in life was to, cheat, steal, not take the right way to do things. That would take too long or too much effort, and that was boring. But to connive, manipulate, and do it that way, and that never worked. I was just living my life in fear of being caught, and And I didn't have any human relations. You know, my contacts with people were, if you gave me an ounce, I would take a lot from you. And, you know, looking back, I just did my fifth step with Jeff on Saturday. And it revealed to me how much I had hurt other people and how little self-esteem I had and how much, you know, I had placed in value on material things, not on character and spiritual matters. But I think my time is up. I heard a beeper, but I'm just grateful to be speaking here at the Atlantic Group. And thanks, everyone.
And our second 10-minute speaker is Dustina.
My name's Dustina. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's July 31st, 2003. My home group is Young and Wise, and I'm working Step 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12. I'm very excited and honored to be speaking tonight. Thanks, Amanda, for asking me. I grew up in San Francisco. Both my parents are alcoholics, and I was very unhappy as a child. But I've heard a lot of alcoholics say that they had really great childhoods. Neither of the parents were alcoholics. So I believe that I would have been this way no matter what my childhood was like. What happened because both my parents are alcoholics is that, you know, my mother got sober. She has 19 years. And so, and my father kind of did the program for like a year and then was dry. So the result of my parents being alcoholics is that I didn't drink, you know, I was kind of a late bloomer because I was really scared of alcohol and I was scared that I was going to be like them. And I also believe that it got me here so fast. You know, I came in when I was barely 18, so I'm so grateful for them for being alcoholics. So my first drink was the summer after my freshman year of high school. I was at a party, and it was kind of a similar moment of insanity to that moment of insanity before I drank for the rest of my drinking career. I thought that it would be okay. So I drank, and I didn't get drunk, really. It wasn't, like, a huge deal. It kind of just felt like a sigh of relief. Later, drinking came to feel like the only way I could breathe at all. But I didn't drink. After that first time, I think that was a really great buzz. I could talk to boys. I felt like I was a part of the party that I was in, and that was good, and that was great. After that point, I think every time I drank alcoholically. I never knew where I was going to end up or what I was going to do, and I always ended up being the one that everyone had to take care of. I was always weeping and throwing things, and so high school, you know, wore on, and I didn't realize at the time I was so unhappy when I wasn't drinking. I was so unhappy. I would, every morning I'd wake up and want to die. I mean, the first thought that came to my head was I'd rather jump out the window than go on with my day. It was just drudgery. Living was just drudgery. And I didn't put it together that alcohol helped that for a while. Some stuff happened, like my mother moved away, and that was when I really realized that if I drank, it would dull the pain. So, I don't know. I continued to drink, and it became apparent, you know, now that I look back at it, that once I put alcohol into my body, I had no control over how much more I was going to put into my body. And looking back on it, I used to think that I never swore off drinking. I would read about that, and I'd be like, I never really did that. I never wanted to stop. But I told many people that I was going to stop drinking. I kind of ruined my best friend's 18th birthday by throwing up all over the table in front of her 40 relatives in the restaurant. She was the last person in the world that I would want to hurt. And I remember just sobbing and telling her, I will never drink again in front of you. I'll never drink with you ever again. I don't want to do this to you anymore. And a couple months later, we were at a party, and these guys were making apple teenies. And I never had an apple teeny before. They put the drink out to me, and I looked at the drink, and I looked at her, and I looked at the drink, and I looked at her, and I took the drink. Because in that moment, I was insane. I thought that it would be okay. I really did. And it wasn't. So what ended up happening was, I'm so lucky. I mean, I really didn't think I was at the time. But my high school intervened. Thank you. And I had this big meeting with, you know, my dean and all of my teachers and my parents, and they were like, you're an alcoholic, she's an alcoholic, and she has to go away, or else, because the whole plan was I was going to go to New York for college. That had been, you know, in the plan for a long time. And then I was going to get all of these people off my back, and I was going to drink the way I wanted to drink, but I was caught, like, 2 weeks before I graduated. I was so mad. So what I ended up doing, I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where my mother lived. You know, she was sober. And I started going to meetings, and I started going to outpatient. I had no intention of stopping drinking. That wasn't why I was doing this. I didn't want to stop. It was the only thing I had. I really felt like it was the only thing that I had, and how dare you tell me that I couldn't do it anymore. But after a couple of weeks of sitting in meetings every day, I was in a meeting, and the topic was being honest with yourself. And I'd just been sitting in the back of the meetings, you know, with my arms crossed, not really being present, and I just started bawling. Like, I hadn't cried like that since I was a little girl. And I just realized, like, to be honest with myself, I mean, the truth is that I'm an alcoholic, and maybe I can try not drinking. My early sobriety is just full of maybes for me. Like, maybe I can do this. And I had my first spiritual experience that summer. I just started my day count over because you're not supposed to take Valium if you can't sleep in early sobriety. So I had like 2 days, and I was gonna go away to college, and I decided that this was just ridiculous. I was 18. This isn't fair. I was going to go drink. So I was kind of in a trance, and I took off in my car, and I went to downtown Santa Fe, and I was going to go to a bar, and I parked my car, and I was just in a trance. I'd made the decision I was going to drink. And I walked past all these different bars. I know now why I didn't go in the one, you know, all the ones that I was passing. And I saw this one bar, and I thought, I'm going to go in there. I'm going in there, and I'm drinking this one bar. And I just come from a meeting where the topic was spiritual experience, and I was sitting there so resentful because I had never had one of those, and I didn't think I ever would. And I tried to walk through the door of this bar, and the bouncer was like, "Hi, Destina," and it was this guy Tate who'd been at the meeting that night. And he looked at me right in the eye, and he's like, "Do you really think that there's not the tiniest possibility that there's something out there that might be looking out for you?" And I said, maybe. And I started praying from that night on. I still didn't believe. I didn't know what I was praying to. I got on my knees, and I was just like, "Hey, God." I didn't know, but, you know, they just told me to do it. And I really felt like that night was so beautiful. I really felt like, you know, God just kind of tapped me on the shoulder and was just like, "Can we start now?" You know? And I said, "Yes, God, we can start now when it comes to drinking, but not with anything else." So the first couple years of my sobriety, I was willing to not drink, but I wasn't willing to stop doing life my way, which is so weird when I look back at it, because why would I want to live my life, you know, my way is just horrible. And I wasn't, you know, going to finish that fourth step, and I wasn't going to, certainly wasn't going to take your advice when it came to romantic relationships. You know, I got myself into trouble in sobriety, and I have been miserable in sobriety. I have been miserable. I've sat in meetings and not felt like I was in AA, and completely isolated and so unhappy. And that's really scary. It's really scary to be unhappy in sobriety, because you can't drink, you know that. But if the alternative is just to be that miserable, So I finally finished that fourth step. It took 14 months, and I did, you know, steps 5 through 12, and I finally started really taking suggestions, and miracles happen when you do that. Thanks. And if you don't think that you can be sober and happy and live a purposeful life, I know what that feels like, and I'm here to tell you that you can. Thank you.
Main speaker tonight is Alonzo.
Thanks. Hi, my name's Alonzo, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Vince for asking me to come and speak at this meeting. And I didn't stand up because it would have been redundant. I'm from L.A. also, so I've been sober for 18 years, and I'm not looking for applause on that. I actually grew up here in New York. I grew up in Queens, so kind of home for the holidays and everything. You know, my story isn't anything spectacular as far as drinking goes. I don't remember exactly when I had my first drink. I know I was a kid. And my dad and his friends used to drink those little Miller ponies. They were like little 7-ounce ones, and it was kind of cute to grab one once in a while. So I think I did that. But the first time that I drank with intention, I know I was about 13, and like a friend of mine likes to say, I had to relieve the everyday pressures of a 13-year-old. And I drank because the guys who were older than me did it, and they were cool. And that was my reason. I wanted to be like them. I mean, I grew up, my family was cool. My parents are still together. You know, they've been married forever. I'm tight with my brother and sister, and nieces and nephews are really special. So it wasn't like I had any, you know, compelling reason to want to do it. It was just something I wanted to do. I wanted to be like them. And the funny thing is, I always wanted to be able to drink as much as they could. Like, that always fascinated me, how much alcohol certain people could consume, and you know, they would sit down and drink like the whole six pack, and I could never make it past three or four. I'd just be out, but that didn't stop me from trying. You know, I worked on it, and the thing about it was, and just a welcome to all the newcomers, and I just want to say this to get it out of the way. I do have some outside issues, you know, besides alcohol, and out of respect to the meeting, I'm not going to talk about that, but I will say that those outside issues helped me to consume more alcohol. Anyway, it worked. You know what I mean? It worked, and it was cool. It was fun. I was going to school. I didn't have any problems in school. I went to aviation high school, which was very interesting, because I was always very good in school, and when I got to aviation, they kind of had two programs. They had the regular school curriculum, and then they had a special curriculum to train us to be airplane mechanics. And as far as I was concerned, that was the only one that was important. The regular school curriculum was just something I was there to do. So I would literally get loaded for regular classes, but I'd be straight for my airplane classes. And I had a teacher talking about, you know, if you were to apply yourself, you have the potential to do anything, to go anywhere. And you know, I was like, yeah, but I can cruise and pass. You know, why really work hard if I don't want to, you know? And when I first got sober, I remember being at a meeting, and a guy talked about potential. And he was like, you know, alcoholics, we have tremendous potential, but alcohol always wins. You know, and I think that was true, definitely true for me at that time. And I've learned a lot about who I was then. I've learned about that since I got sober. And my thing back then, my overriding attitude was, what do you want me to do so that I can do it and you will leave me alone? That was my goal. My goal was to be left alone. So if I was in school, my thing was, okay, if I get good grades, they will leave me alone. You know, my parents had two basic rules. They were like, do good in school and don't go to jail. And as far as I was concerned, that left a lot of leeway for what I was allowed to do and get, and I did. And I was that kind of kid. You know, I had a smart mouth. I was good in school, et cetera, et cetera. And I graduated and I was hired by Lockheed in California. That's when I moved to Burbank. And basically what happened then was the party continued. They hired a few hundred guys from my high school. So if you can imagine, you know, 300 18-year-olds leaving New York, moving to California, having a great job waiting. I mean, the party continued in a major way. And it worked. And it was fine because it worked. So we would, you know, we'd go to work every day. We were very good at what we did. On weekends at night or whatever, we'd have our parties, we'd do our thing, and it was fine. And I was pretty happy then. You know, my life had been, the only way I can describe it is a charmed life. When I was in high school, I had a great job. I worked at a catering place that did like weddings and dinner dances and stuff like that, which was great because I could drink at work for free. You know, I mean, it was there. So once your party was over, our party began, you know, and that's what we would do. And I made great money and I was happy. And then I left there. I went to Lockheed. Everything increased. You know, this was the early 80s and I got the stuff. You know, I got the apartment and I got the car and I got the motorcycle and the stereo and the TV. And it was all working. It was coming together and I was doing my thing and it wasn't any problem. And then I got to a point where I decided I needed her. Like that was the next step. I need to have her. And I met this girl and it looked like her. You know, it looked like her. It smelled like her. It wasn't her. You know, wasn't even close to her. But again, I've learned this in sobriety. We had the perfect alcoholic relationship. She actually came to my apartment building to see some other guy. You know, then we met, we ended up hanging out, and by the end of the month, we were living together. You know, and so what happened was after a few months, and now I'm in my early 20s, I guess right, maybe 21, 22, still relatively young, I got laid off. And that was scary because it was the first time something went wrong. I was out of work. I hadn't been out of work since I was 15 and I didn't know what to do. But what I found out was I was highly employable because I was young. I was licensed as an airplane mechanic, had my training, and I had experience. I had job offers coming in within a week. So now losing a job wasn't a problem. It was like, okay, good. I can always find another job. But she and I started having problems and I got a job in Santa Barbara, which is about 100 miles north of LA. I would work up there during the week and come home on weekends. And I came home one weekend and she was gone. And when I say she was gone, I mean everything was gone. I literally came home to carpet. And I laugh about it now, but at the time it was devastating. It was because I had never learned to deal with anything going wrong. And I certainly had never learned to deal with pain and this hurt. And the only thing that stopped it from hurting was getting loaded. That was the only thing that stopped. And I like to be very clear about this. I believe I was an alcoholic from the start. I really do. I always liked drinking. I always liked, you know, getting loaded. And I liked doing it alone, which is another big clue or whatever. But when she left and I felt that pain, that's when I stopped caring about any of the outside stuff. And that's when stuff started to go away. You know, that's when I didn't care about paying the bills anymore, so my credit got ruined and my car got repossessed and I gave up the apartment and I started doing geographics because I was still very employable because I was very good as an airplane mechanic and I got involved with this company and we dealt with airplanes that had like ground accidents. Like occasionally you hear about it in the news, an airplane will go off the runway into the water, or two airplanes will collide on the ground or whatever. And I worked with the group that they'd send to whatever city this happened, and we would rebuild the plane. We did one here at Kennedy. I came home for about 4 or 5 months and did that one. And that's when I was convinced I didn't want to live in New York again. Love visiting, but I was like, I can't handle it. I'm an LA guy now. My brother is always talking about how lazy I am and how I stroll and don't walk. But anyway, I that's what I started doing. I was moving around the country doing geographics, doing these jobs, and it was great. It was the perfect job for an alcoholic because the company took care of flying me there. They paid my living expenses. I was making a lot of money. My only responsibility was showing up for work every day, which wasn't a problem because that's what we were there to do. And they liked us because there were a lot of guys in that group that had really flaky and weird backgrounds, but we were willing to work 6-7 days a week, 12-15 hours a day. We were good at what we did, so the company kind of turned a blind eye to what we did when we were off of work, you know. So anyway, so I lived like that, and I did that for a few years. And again, it was one more thing that worked until it stopped working, you know. And the first jobs, it was fine, and I was there for months. And then the second job, I was there for a few months, and I moved around. And I ended up, what happened was, I ended up working in Dallas. And this is after doing this for a couple of years. And I had bottomed, you know, again. Because, see, each trip, geographics, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's me traveling around the country or traveling wherever trying to escape from me. And the problem is, and again, I've learned this in sobriety, wherever I went, I'd be there. So the plan was great, but it was only a limited success. It was only a matter of time before me and my ideas and my lifestyle and what I did caught up with me, and I would hit another bottom. So Dallas was the first time I hit a bottom, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I needed help. You know, and I called my mother, and I said, look, I'm stuck. You know, the job is, I've been laid off, and I was very lucky. I never got fired. I'd always get laid off, which was great, because that meant you could always go to the next job and start over with a clean record. But anyway, so I told her I needed money to get home, and she asked me if I wanted to come to New York or L.A., and I told her I wanted to go to L.A. because I considered L.A. home. And she sent me the money, and the same day, a friend of mine called, and he was driving across the country, and he said, if you could throw your stuff in the truck, help me drive, we'll go to L.A., won't cost you anything. And I was cool. And as soon as I hung up the phone, I didn't have a problem anymore. See, I dodged the bullet one more time. So the money my mother sent me, well, that just went to a few more days of having fun, you know, doing my thing. And then he showed up, and we drove to L.A., and it started again. And I got my old job back at Lockheed, the company I had started with. And after about 4 months, I was in trouble. I was going to get fired because I was missing work. Because Lockheed paid on Thursday. And you can't pay an alcoholic on Thursday if you're open on Friday. Because that's not a priority come Friday morning. And what happened was, this was in the late 80s. And in the late 80s, rehab was booming. It was. There were rehabs everywhere. And they felt sorry for you. And they, oh, you've got a problem. We're here to help, you know. And I worked for a huge company, and they actually had a guy whose job was to help people with recovery. You go to him and you say, I got a problem, and he decides, do you need outpatient or inpatient or whatever, and he sends you to a program, and then you come back and your record's clean, and you could do this 3 times. And you better believe we all knew how this scam worked, because that's how you kept from getting fired. So I did. I went to the guy, I said, I got a problem, and he sent me to some outpatient place. And, you know, they said, okay, you're here, you gotta give up everything. And I was like, really, you don't understand. You know, I have a problem with certain things. There's no need for me to give up everything. You guys are getting a little excessive here, you know. And they explained to me, I didn't understand, and I had to give up everything. And I lasted 2 weeks. I stayed sober 2 weeks. And I was at a meeting, and a guy said, man, if you don't remember the last time you got loaded, you're not done yet. And I was like, wow, I don't remember the last time I got loaded. So I'm going to get really loaded tonight and remember it. And then I'll be ready to do this thing. And that's what I did. And I went on another run, and I was, you know, and 2 months, 3 months later, 2 or 3 months later, I got busted. That had never happened to me before. I had never been arrested. And when I got arrested and I was in the back of the police car with the handcuffs on, I remembered that word powerless. Because you guys had told me I was powerless and I didn't believe you for 1 minute. You know, back when I've always worked out. I was a big guy. You know, when I got sober, a lot of people, you know, oh, I weighed 130 pounds. Not me. I was about 210, solid muscle. And intimidation was my tool. I would never put a hand on you because I knew you could get arrested for doing that. But there was no law against me scaring you to death. excuse me. At the time, I lived in the San Fernando Valley, which is a predominantly white suburban kind of part of L.A. So when you told me I was powerless, I was like, no, I'm not. When I walk down the street, white people cross the street and walk on the other side. I have power. People do what I say. That was my thinking. That's where my head was. So when I had the cuffs on in the back of the police car, I remembered that word powerless, and I knew exactly what you meant. And what happened that night, without me realizing it maybe in that moment, but what happened that night, I found willingness. And I think that's been the key to my sobriety ever since. I've always been willing to do what it takes to stay sober. Now, there have definitely been times when it was 51% willingness and 49% alcoholism. But the 51% was enough to keep me sober through those days. And what happened, I got out of jail the next day, and I got drunk one last time because it was a Sunday and I didn't know what to do. And Monday I went back to the rehab place I was in and I talked my way back in and I was there now. And I wanted to get sober and I wasn't there to keep a job. I had actually been laid off in the meantime. One more time, dodged that bullet, got laid off rather than fired. But I just wanted to stay sober. And suddenly, everything that I had heard 2 months before that was a joke and a lie and you people don't know what you were talking about, suddenly it made sense and I was grabbing onto every word. And there was a panel that came in and there was this girl on the panel and she was beautiful, you know, and she said she was from New York and then she rambled on something about alcoholism. I didn't hear any of that. I just knew that she was from New York and I had a way in, you know, because I had over 2 weeks of sobriety, so obviously I'm what she was looking for, you know. And I went up to her after the meeting, and it was funny because she knew exactly what I was up to, and she was like, all right, stop right there, stop it. I'm married, but a lot of women like me go to this place called Studio 12. And I was like, I don't know where it is, but that's my home group. And because that's how we picked meetings. Me and the guys in this rehab, we would scout looking for where the hot women go. That's a good meeting. And I went to this place, Studio 12, and she introduced me to a guy, and she said, Alonzo, this is going to be your sponsor. And she walked off. And I didn't see her again for 3 years. But now I had a sponsor. And I'll always be grateful for Studio 12, because I walked in, and I ran into the exact group of guys who I needed to meet. These guys were like, sit down, shut up, and listen. You're a newcomer. You don't know anything. You're going to do what we tell you. And they would walk away. They would never stick around for my rebuttal. You know, but I needed that. And I've learned in sobriety that approach doesn't work with everybody. Some people need a compassionate approach, a loving approach, a this, that. I needed that. I needed guys who these guys saw right through me. They used to tell me, like, you're lying. I'm like, well, how do you know? I'm like, you're a newcomer. You're lying. You know. But I had to believe them because they knew. Because I could start a lie and they would finish it and I'd be like, oh, you heard that one. They knew. And the big thing for me is I found out I wasn't the only one. Because I liked to do it alone. And meeting and hearing other people who did what I did made it a huge thing because now I wasn't the only one. They told me to read the book. I love to read. I read the book in like 4 days. And the thing that blew my mind about this book, I was like, how did these two guys 50 years ago know exactly how I feel? Know exactly how I think? I knew something was going on here. And I did what they told me. They told me to go to meetings. They told me to pray. They told me to talk to another alcoholic and work the steps with my sponsor. And it was a weird thing because I came in with a group of people and like our sponsors were all friends. Our sponsors all had like 2, 3, maybe 5 years. And they would pick on us mercilessly. But like my sponsor wouldn't pick on me. He would pick on all of my friends, and their sponsors wouldn't pick on them. They would pick on me, and they, you know, it was a weird kind of thing. But whenever they tell us to do something, we'd all have to check with each other. You know, so it'd be like, hey, my sponsor told me to do it. Did your sponsor? Yeah, yours too. Yeah, did you? Yeah. Oh, we, I guess we better do it. Yeah, I think we got to do it. You got to do it, right? Did you do it? And we would have, because, you know, you're new, you don't have a job, you got coffee, you're up till 4 a.m, you talk about these things. And we did it. And we did it together. And it was amazing. And every lesson they taught me, they never told me about the lesson. They just told me what to do. And I got the lesson as a result. They had a row of wooden chairs in the front. And my brother's here. And my brother, I'm not violating his anonymity. He's sober, too. And he used to come to L.A. and visit. So he knows these places and these guys. And they had a row of chairs, and they called it Death Row. It was a row of wooden chairs. And the newcomers would sit there. And this girl was moving. And Tom, who ran the place, he looked over at us and he said, any of you got a driver's license? And I had completed my community service, so I had a license. And I said, I do. And he said, all right, you're driving a truck and the rest of you are lifting furniture. Be here Saturday at 9 a.m. And he looked at her and said, don't give them money, just give them a pizza because they're new, they'll get drunk. And he walked away. And we didn't know what to do, but we were like, you're going to be there at 9 o'clock? We got to be there. We're going to be there. We showed up and we moved her stuff. And the next week he had another moving job. And the next week he had, I'm telling you, we spent a whole summer. We got so good at it that if you were moving, we just needed to know where from, where to, get out the way. We got this. Now, what Tom didn't tell us was we were spending the weekend together amongst each other staying sober. We would be tired at night, so we wouldn't be looking to go out and do this and do that. And we bonded, and I always share about these bonds. There was a group of us, and it was me and Marlon and Brian and Ava and Philip. Ava, who's one of my dearest friends, she used to cook and she used to feed us, which made her more important than anyone in the group. And what happened is in October, Marlon was 19, and this month Ava's 19, and next month Brian will be 19. And in March, I'll be 19. And the only guy we've lost who's gone in and out has been Philip. And we developed bonds that are incredible. You know, I was at Ava's wedding. I was at the hospital the night she had her baby. When Katrina hit and Brian lives in just outside of New Orleans, he called me and Ava, right? And we, you know what I mean? We're all over the country now. We're doing our lives. We formed those kind of bonds because we got sober together. So now, a few years later, I'm back to work in aerospace. I'm teaching new people mechanics. It's a good job, but I'm tired of it. And at 5 years sober, I said, I want to be a comic. And they said, you can do that. And I said, how? And they said, we don't know. But you can do it. Don't worry about the money. Don't just do what's in front of you. And I did it. And I took this comedy class. And the first time I did it, this guy, Charles, there was a bunch of sober people there supporting me. But Charles was a guy who I'd always looked up to in sobriety and would always pick on me, you know. And Charles looked at me after the show and he said, looks like we finally found out what God meant for you to do. And that was the exact feeling I had coming off that stage. It was incredible. And I've been doing it since, and my career has been phenomenal. I'll still complain about it at times because I'm an alcoholic. So no matter how good it gets, I can always find a complaint. But the truth of the matter is, I've traveled literally around the world. You know, I make a living doing what I love doing. I'm a toy guy. My God knows I am a shallow, materialistic guy. And if I don't get a new toy on a regular basis, I'm not good to be around. And I have this kind of relationship with my God. He's got a tremendous sense of humor, and he don't mind me driving cars and riding motorcycles and stuff like that. And I have those toys now. Sobriety taught me that's what they are. They're toys. They're fun. They're not the most important thing. My sponsor is a big toy guy. My sponsor, when I was new, he was into Porsches. And he would show up at meetings with Porsches. And I was like, man, I'm going to get a Porsche one day. And he's a little fat guy. And he said, yeah, I wanted to be tall and thin, but we don't always get what we want. And at 9 years sober, I bought a used Porsche and I drove up to a meeting and he was there in a Ferrari just to let me know, you know. But the thing was, a few years after that, we were both having real slow years and work wasn't going well. And he sold his and I sold mine. And it was like, that's just the way it goes. Then you get good, you get them again and so on. And he and I have agreed, we don't talk to other people about cars with any sober rationality because you guys don't understand that we need to buy these things. So anyway, career-wise, my life is phenomenal, and I love it. And the only way I can describe it is I live a dream I did not have when I got here. It wasn't like I wanted to do this ever since I was a little kid or anything else. I found this in sobriety. I always had a sense of humor. I could always make people laugh, but I would make them laugh at you to belittle you and to make me bigger. When I got sober, they laughed at me until I could laugh at myself, and that's when the gift came out, and I get to use it. And I love that. Now, flash forward some more years. At 10 years sober, I'm single the whole time. And emotionally, I have not really grown up. I've grown up some, but I haven't really grown up. And you know, I'll never do this and I'll never do that. And they don't ever say never. Well, see, I was never going to get in a relationship sober. Like, I wasn't going to get in any sober relationship beyond a convention weekend. That was okay. Any more than that could be trouble. And I didn't get into one, I got into two, you know, with two women in the same home group, and it was a mess. It was, yeah, you shake your heads like you wouldn't do it. Yeah, watch. Judge me all you want. It was a mess, and it was very damaging and painful, and every bad thing you could think happened did happen. And the worst part was the girl who I tried to, quote, protect, everything I would do would hurt her more. And the girl I was pursuing, she just kept running away because she had her own thing. And I was going crazy. And Daryl, who's my sponsor today, I asked him, would he help me? And he said, yeah. He said, and I'm glad you asked because you were on your way out. Because I had never worked on my emotional sobriety. And we got back into the book and we got back into the steps one more time with the goal of my growth emotionally. And the way that worked out, the girl who I kept hurting, this is a level of forgiveness that I can't even believe. A few years after that, she was married and she had a baby because that was her dream. She wanted a family. And she called me the day the baby was born to let me know that she was okay and the baby was okay and she was happy. And the other girl, we have a relationship now, friendship, whatever, and it's been done. It, you know, I worked through that in sobriety. The women in this program, I love the women in this program, and I don't mean it on any romantic or sexual level. I mean the women in this program are the ones who allowed me to feel. I'm a man. I come from that tall, tough guy, hold it in. The women were never scared. They said, you need to cry, you can cry, and you need to feel. And they defined feelings that I didn't even know how to define. And I think women are just naturally better at that, and that is something, a debt I have in sobriety. And the last thing I always want to talk about are my nieces and nephew, because I've been sober their whole life. And I get to be an uncle. And they are spoiled. And they know it. And now that I've been on TV, they're really spoiled. And I love that. It's a lot of fun because I get to enjoy it, but I also get to share it. When my niece started high school, I told her about my story. And I said, if you ever have a problem, a question, whatever, you can talk to me. I've been there. I'm going to try to avoid you wasting a lot of your life like I did. And I'll probably have that talk with my nephew soon because he's getting to that age, you know. But it's a beautiful thing. And these kids blow me away because there was a time when I was playing catch with my nephew when he was starting Little League, and I wanted to cry because it hit me in that moment that you guys took an alcoholic and made him a hero to a little kid. You know, and when I visited my niece at her high school and I'm driving up and I hear her tell her friend, that's my uncle and he's my best friend. And I literally have to slow down because I'm going to cry again because now it's a 16-year-old girl and I get that. That's what sobriety has given me. I have all the other stuff and it's beautiful, but those are the moments that really matter to me. If you're new here, stay sober through the holidays. You can do it. Hang close, do what we do, or be angry. Hate and resent us and show us that, yeah, well, next year I'll be back, whatever it takes. But you can stay sober through the holidays. I know it's weird time when you're newly sober and be a part of. Look for the similarities, not the differences. And believe us, no matter how good we look on the outside, particularly at this meeting, because, you know, we all dress up and we look great. And you're like, you couldn't be an alcoholic. You're wearing a suit. I stole it. No. We're alcoholics inside. I believe that. No matter how we look on the outside, we feel the same. We overreact the same, we think the same, and everything you read about the alcoholic in his book is true of me. I can't speak for everyone. I can say it's absolutely true of me. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober 18 years. I'm still an alcoholic. There are still times when I will be so self-centered or self-pity or resentment or anger. I could pick any emotion and go on a run, just like a drinking run. I'm going to be angry. So whatever happens today, I'm just going to be more angry. Because I'm in that mindset, and I find the solutions in here. And I still do the things that they taught me to do when I was new. I have a home group. I go to it every Monday night that I can. I travel a lot, so I can't always make it, but I go to that. I still talk to my sponsor on a regular basis. I pray, you know, the work steps. I do that stuff because I get to stay sober. Because one of the things they told me was that if I choose to drink, then I'm making a conscious decision to give up everything that I've gained. And you know something? I don't want to do that. And it's not the house and the cars and the bikes and all that stuff, which is good. It's the people. I don't want to give up the people in my life. That is one area where I am blessed. Like a friend of mine says, God didn't give me the script, but the cast is phenomenal. And that's how I live. And thank you for letting me share.